Staging Sound, a podcast reflecting on theatre music, sound design, sonic practices and experiences. Great. Okay. So welcome to Staging Sound, a podcast all about staging sound, as it's called. So today I'm very fortunate to have two esteemed guests on this podcast talking about recent scholarship. The main person today is Leonie Persin, who's a dramaturg, a performance maker, an academic, who has just graduated literally weeks ago from Ghent University at the Department of Music, Visual Arts and Performance Studies. She was supervised there by Christine Stalpert and Martine Huven. She was trained as a visual artist originally in Antwerp and as an art historian in Ghent. And her PhD project, and this will make it very obvious while she is a very welcome guest on this podcast, is entitled The Sound of a Shared Intimacy, a Phenomenological Research into Sound or Sounding and Listening in Performance Practices. So it's very much at the heart of what interests us here. And in order to, for me not to be alone with this, and in order for an added, very welcome perspective, we have a sort of a regular of this podcast, a regular guest who's Lynn Kendrick, and we've had her on talking about various projects in presentations and in book launches and other formats as well. So welcome back, Lynn. She works at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama as a reader for new theatre practices there. And we go quite a way back because in 2011 we co-edited a book entitled Theatre Noise. So already, and this was called The Sound of Performance, already in that area. And in 2017, she published Theatre Orality, which has really become a core text on audiences and their experiences of sound-based theatre. She's also founded and directed theatre companies such as the Camden People's Theatre. And she also, for full transparency, she was part of the review committee or the jury, I think it's called in Ghent, of Leonie's PhD. So she's also very familiar with her work and is one of the early readers, of which we hope there will be many because it's a very fascinating work. And just to get us sort of in the, just to get our ears tuned up a little bit for this, I just wanted to ask you, Leonie, can you describe maybe a recent sort of listening experience, something that where listening has become, again, something that we usually do very unconsciously, but that has sort of has been foregrounded for you?
Yes, I have. Actually, I have two. I have one very recent from last Friday where I was in a concert of Gabriel Rios, who's a Puerto Rican musician. And he made a new album based on traditionals from Puerto Rican and his new version of those standards. Let's say he made his own new standards based on his family tradition. Of course, it's in Spanish, a language which is not mine, which I don't understand. And it was in a church, so already there the acoustics were very specific, very big for even the tiniest movements they did, or even so. What for me was very particular there is that the concert became better during the timing, and it was a good reminder that it takes time to get to know a space when you are dealing with sound, because at the end they really started playing with how long a sound took to become quiet again, and there is something very magical happened. So to experience that again for me is always a good reminder of why I started dealing with sound and listening. Also to feel how important that was, that that church was filled with people and what that did in return to the sound. Also when they started clapping alone, we were on the side in the back of the church, and how you feel how long it took the clapping sound to travel, that it even became out of rhythm, and all these kind of things that I have been dealing with on a rather theoretical level outside of pleasure and going to concerts, suddenly were there in a very primitive experience I had again. So it was really like a circle that went around, and that I entered where I began to say, in just the listening experience to some music I really like to hear. And also what was very striking is that although the language was Spanish and I'm not managing the Spanish language, it was very nice to hear the storytelling element that was supported through the music they played, so that you could feel that it was not just music, but it was loaded with a family history and with a lot of personal stories, but also with a history of a very particular place, which I don't know, which I don't understand until then, which I didn't came about, but I could just sense it in how certain notes were tackled, how certain sounds were sent into space or sent towards an audience. So yeah, that was a very nice remembrance. And then the second one is actually a book which is borderline visible by Ant Hantum, and they have a series which is called Time-Based Editions, where they introduce, now the second edition just arrived here and there, they make a soundtrack on an existing book and adding a cover. But the first one was a book he made based on his research he did on migration and traveling together to search how to retrace actually the migration of a particular person he collaborated with. And there for me it was very interesting to see how that sound really changed the experience of reading a book, and how it completely challenged all the codes that were in there, in a similar way that for me sound can also challenge the codes within a black box, or within, so it can completely change how you read without you having like the strict codes explained to you beforehand. So it's changed while doing it, and you immediately understand it, and it immediately starts resonating within your body. So it immediately does something with how you audience or how you read. So that was the second one I found really interesting. Less through the sounds I heard, but more about what the listening does in an immediate response.
Thank you, though, because I mean, you've managed to weave in so many interesting themes already in those two examples, the communal aspect of listening, also the listening by performers themselves, you know, as you were saying about the church, that you could kind of sense the performers themselves starting to listen to the reverberance and adapting and so forth. And then also with the book, the kind of transformative notion that listening changes something, and also you mentioned body, it's a physical experience, so already we have a few buzzwords to start off from.
Thank you, Leonie, for those descriptions. It reminds me of my favorite moment in your thesis is when you did this really detailed analysis of Weber Krebs's production The Guardians of Sleep, and how the whole atmosphere, sonography, and indeed the experience of the work, you pointed out, hinged on this directorial instruction, which is when Weber Krebs said to the performers, "Now I want you to listen to everything that's taking place." And this is a crucial moment in the production when the performers move from the first part of the show to the second part of the show of sleeping and resting. But it, rather than it being the body moving down and going to sleep, actually is that shift from performing, looking, all the senses firing away, specifically to the performers listening. And that was both an instruction that you were privy to because you were working as a dramaturg on the project, but was also really palpable in the final production itself. So that was really got to the essence of what your project was about for me, is that we're not just being metaphorical about sound and listening, we're actually looking at the ways in which this functions within processes and has an impact, therefore, on how things are performed and therefore how things, the mechanisms of the work and how things are received. So that for me was one of the most beautiful moments. But have you seen other incidences of this shift from one sense to the other in other practices? You're talking about the experience of listening to music in a church, certainly is often the case. But do you have any other examples of that you'd like to share with us?
So from the shift of being engaged to listening, Yeah, I think as clear as it was in The Guardians of Sleep because of the direction note, no, but I think if I look also to the other practices involved, it is always there in a sense. It's always exactly that shift that they are after. And with the Bibi Krebs, it was there for the performers. It was a request towards the performers. But for example, in the work of the Dutch theater maker Rita Hofweg I'm working with, it's she who makes that request towards her audience. And it's that which I found very interesting. And for me, that is what a practice dealing with listening is after or is doing. It's formulating that invitation or that request. So for me, what came about in the project is that the works I have been analyzing and I have been in dialogue with are exactly those invitations or those requests. So I think in each of the performers I'm dealing with in the project, I think there it's always about that shift and about how you make that shift. And I think it's there on a daily basis. I think most people who experienced it can have experienced it in a meditative context. It's not a context which I use in my PhD, but if you meditate, you often switch from one sense to the other. And it's about, I think, the same thing how I understand listening is about opening up multisensorial way, so that you allow what is there to happen and to acknowledge that it is happen without trying to intercept it or interfere with it, just being part of it and being surrounded by what is happening. So you can have it while you cook, where you certainly hear the boiling water in all its textures, or I now recently had it while waiting to fall asleep as well, and the neighbors living in apartment buildings, neighbors putting on the heating, and then suddenly you hear the whole system that goes through the building, and first you're frustrated, but then you just start listening to it, then you discover all these difficult textures that are there, these different rhythms that are there, so that it's no longer frustrating, but it becomes interesting. So also there, the shift in attention and the shift in allowance also does something.
Great. Maybe just for the benefit of those listeners who haven't read the PhD, who will be in the majority, can you take us back just a step? Because we're right at the heart of it already, which is great. But are those kind of observations, those moments that you've described very vividly, were those kind of the trigger, like the starting point where you felt like, I've seen things, I've dealt with listening as a theatre maker, as a dramaturg, and I really need to explore this in a more theoretical and more methodical way? Or what was the spark? How did you get on that journey, and how did this topic sort of become clearer and materialize as clearly defined as it was in the final thesis?
I think there's two very specific elements that triggered it. One is more a research element, and the other one is a very personal element. Already from childhood, I can remember that when I was sick, I was with my grandparents, and then you're on a couch and their life is continuing, and certainly you are part through your ears in a very intimate situation which you never get to witness. So there, for me, it was always triggered, like when I hear them in the kitchen doing their daily things, having their relation to each other, and witnessing that in a way that I, on other days when I'm not sick, that I don't witness it. That was a very vivid and strong experience that was always coming back to me, like something is happening there that I don't necessarily understand what is happening or why it is so touching in a way. So that is the earliest element in my experience with sound that I can remember, like how that touched me. So on a personal level, that was a trigger in sound, which only later became so important as I started the research. And then in a research context, when I started my bachelor thesis and my master thesis, I was working on the work of the Belgian filmmaker Chantal Akkerman, and more specifically on the work Toute une nuit, which I call an ode to Brussels. So she follows 13 characters from dawn till dusk. So how do they move through the night? And they almost don't speak. And for me also, it's such an collage of characters so that you never get to know them. There's not really a story. So the first time I watched that movie, I felt left out. I felt, what should I do with this? I cannot make sense of it. I don't understand it, but I do feel that same closeness which I had in the experience of being sick on the couch with my grandparents. So you're very close, because also there the sound montage is made louder than it should actually be. So you hear a lot of the rubbing of the clothes. So at first it's very strange, because you hear that there's something different than normal in which sounds you hear when which you don't, which correlates on the one hand with the night, but also it's a bit shifted in how it is put together in the montage. And that was something I worked 2 years on, just to not really make sense, but trying to understand what that sound was doing in that movie. And it was way more than I could have ever expected when I started there. And there it is that my fascination for listening, because there also I saw that the characters themselves were listening a lot to their environment, to themselves. So listening became also a topic in the film for me, and then also in the relation to the audience and how I was listening. I remember a moment that I was working on my thesis with open windows in the city, and that certainly the sounds I heard from the city I was working in and the sounds of the city, the characters were starting to interfere. So also there something happened. And it's actually in those moments that I started to realize, if it has that strong effect already in a film, what does it do then in a performance constellation where you are part of the same space, where you share those same sounds? I became interesting to go back to performance. What can this do then in a performative context? I started working as a dramaturg, and I felt that I was a listening dramaturg, and more than being focused on how things looked or how things, I was very much focused on what is the relation to me as an audience member. That also had to do with that I was often in the rehearsal space more as a production manager than as a dramaturg. So I see that as an opportunity, because I didn't have to interfere. I could just be there, observe it, think about it. And only in moments where I wanted it, or where, for example, David wanted me to have a reaction, or one of the performers came with a struggle, then I could say what I had experienced. It was there that I experienced that I was a listening dramaturg, or dramaturg working through listening more than through looking and trying to understand and to make sense more on listening, and how that shapes the relationship of all those that are there. So that is actually how I came to listening, and how it brought me back to performance. I only wrote in my dissertation on works that I was part of the production process, or I had a close collaboration with the artists that made them, because for me it's very important to have spent time with those cases and not only seeing them once and then starting to reflect on them. So it was important to have a dialogue.
Thank you, Leonie. I think I was just reflecting myself as you were telling your story there, particularly engaging in how film really struggles to stage listening and only really has recourse to the visual image to show us listening. And I always think of The Conversation, the one with Gene Hackman, as the ultimate film in which we're thinking of ways to really show that intense relationship. But also the other interesting thing with theatre and performance is that no one can see you listening, right? And I think this makes for a really interesting clandestine, almost, methodology for being a dramaturg. And whereas dramaturgy, of course, is being figured as something very much about tangible research, planning, coming up with things which map out and make sense of a rehearsal process. And you have this almost subversive, personal approach to dramaturgy, which is something else I just wanted to reflect on as being really an exciting development in terms of theatre and performance dramaturgy, because then there's a question of relationship between agency and dramaturgy and listening and the broader collaborative process.
Yes, I completely agree. And I just wanted to add one film which had a similar effect on me, which I carry around me a lot also in my teaching practice, which is called Touch the Sound, which is already quite a good title, which is a documentary about the work of the Scottish percussionist Evelyn Glennie, who is not only a world-class musician, but she's also what would be called deaf or hard of hearing in a sort of medical sense. And that's a quite fascinating film because it really does try, again, through visuality to show listening and to show auditory events, et cetera, et cetera. But thank you, Lynn, for your observation. I just wanted to, because you were saying I was a listening dramaturg, Leonie, and I just was curious, how did the listening dramaturg and the listening researcher in you get on? Was that sometimes a struggle? Because, I mean, they're two different jobs to do. And I completely get how, with the phenomenological approach, you know, being in that room was part of your methodology. But I feel, how did that relation go within yourself?
Yeah, so I position myself very clearly in my dissertation as a researcher as dramaturg, so a researcher that can only work through those dramaturgical practices and with those dramaturgical strategies and incorporate them in how to do research. For me, doing research and doing dramaturgy are very much entangled, and it is listening and audiencing that is active in that hyphen between those two. And it's not about, and that's something I have from Crystal Stalpart, who is really dealing with those hyphenated concepts and what they are doing or what they can do. And it's not that it is or the researcher or the dramaturg are privileged. They are equal to each other. So for me, the work I do as a dramaturg is equal to that of the research. And I think it's that makes it possible to do both and to not letting them conflict anymore, because there's, for me, no hierarchy in what is the most important function I have. It's just that it shifts, and sometimes I'm more the dramaturg and sometimes I'm more the researchers, and it's a way to step in and out of certain practices and to get closer to certain strategies, but always dealing with listening from a different angle. So in that way, for me, it's very much a phenomenological perspective, because you're bracketing from different perspectives, but you always are looking to the same thing, in this case listening and how it functions and what it does. So for me, they have never felt conflicting. On the contrary, they feed very much into each other. Although I must say that I feel working in a strictly academic context that it is sometimes, it makes things more difficult, because I feel that I'm not researching in a very classical, and I use brackets on the classical way. So I do feel that by incorporating those dramaturgical strategies and those artistic strategies, that you start challenging something in the academic sphere, but also the other way around, by using those concepts and reflecting on them in that academic context, it gives me elements that I can give back to the artists I'm working with, certain references or certain concepts that open up their practice. So for me, they are very much in dialogue, just as how I'm in dialogue with the artists I'm working with. So they have never been in conflict. And it's also something that I experienced combining researching and teaching, that it's always good to step out once in a while. So it's something that also gives me the opportunity to let certain things rest some rest, and to then come back to, yeah.
Absolutely. I just wanted to add a question, because I've not seen a PhD yet that came sort of in four volumes in some ways, because of course you had a core PhD text, but you had three wonderfully made books, or, you know, collections, one could say, called A Series of Suggestions. And then also we should add, there is a layer of visual art that you've sort of developed, again, as a methodology of trying to come to terms with the perennial problem of how do we write about sound and sound experiences and about listening? Because the minute we translate it into language, even if it's not academic language, but just language, it becomes very tricky. So tell us a bit about how you approach that, and what sort of role those different forms of publications, outputs played in you coming to terms with your subject.
Yeah, so first of all, I think A Series of Suggestions very much deals with how my research from of being a research focused on sound and listening in performances shifted towards a research on sound and sounding, or sounding and listening in collaborational practice. So it became a phenomenological exploration of listening and the effective and intimate dimensions of collaborations in performance practices. So which is very, a very big shift from performances to performance practice, and that dialogue with those artists and their experiences and my experience became more important. And then of course we, in the period I was working on a project, there was the COVID-19 pandemic. And in that time, for me, the question became very urgent on how I could give back to the artists I had been working with. Because for me, it was very easy to keep on working, to keep on doing what I was doing. But for them, it became problematic. So that question always had been there, but suddenly it was triggered more by the pandemic. And that is how, on the one side, how a series of suggestions came about. But also, I'm aiming to do dramaturgy and to do phenomenology. So for me, also doing that is also transmitting that to an audience. And how can you transmit that co-creative play where you are in between artists, concepts, bodies? How can you transmit that to an audience? And for me, the only element that could do this, that was by inviting them in that process. And how can you share that whole 7-year-long process that becomes for the book? You write a book, but how do you share that whole process and that shift and that searching and that doubting together? And that's where I developed a series of suggestions. So a series of suggestions is, for me, a publication format. I made an edition with each of the artists I'm writing about. And each edition is a box with 5 folders, which can be read as a book, but you can also unfold them and have that same content in a different constellation. You can also turn those posters the other way around, and then you get a sort of artwork made by all the artists in case, or by me, or in dialogue, where you get that same information, but again, in a different way. And why was it so important to do that? Is so, on the one hand, to give back to the artist, on the other hand, to transmit that experience of doing a phenomenology rather than reflecting on it, but also yet to reevaluate that process in academia. And what is now really nice is that it became a format that even can stand on itself. So now we already feel that we want to prolong it and that we want to start playing with it. So we now, for like the launch of the last edition, we invite new artists and they make a new suggestion based on one of the editions that they got. So it's also a way for the artists themselves to invite other people to deal with their work and their practice, and so to expand a kind of network of suggestions, we call it. And then we invite an audience to an afternoon where all these new suggestions are being presented, but also where we read together that practice. So it is really a practice of knowing, suggesting, doubting together, which enables me as a researcher to invite new artists to make new editions, but also invites the artists themselves to invite new artists with which they want to collaborate, and even to invite an audience in it. And that there's a visual aspect. Also, it was a way to incorporate the principles that were at work in the case studies, to use them also in how I tell my story of listening, so that also there the audience reading my PhD can experience those principles firsthand. It's through a completely other format, but it's based on that same principles that I found were crucial or essential to the practices I dealt with, and in which sound and listening is so important. So that for me is where the series comes about. Yeah.
I think the question as to how we research and how we articulate sound is so important. And what I really enjoyed about the 3 books, the series of suggestions, is that these were manoeuvres towards sharing and articulating the practice of listening with those artists, but also on reading them, I felt it was manoeuvres towards the sound of the practice of listening with those artists. So I guess my final thought would be your thesis, your project was about the sound of all these shared intimacies of listening practices. And from my perspective on reading these, I felt that the artwork and the visuals and the constructs and the way we moved through them was a way of articulating that sound and a way of coping, as you said, David, with the difficult question of limited language to talk about it and a really limited means to really express those processes. So that's what I felt was the real achievement with the series of suggestions, was partly a way of coping with that methodological problem, but also a series of suggestions as to how we can find different mechanisms.
Yeah, and that, there it is, where it connects back to earlier steps in developing my methodology, because I felt at a certain point that I was one that the discourse that I came about from the literature study often dealt with a visual language, which for me made it more difficult to find those words to talk about sound and to in trying to describe my experience, to find that those words that enabled me to capture the complexity of those experiences, because it was always a big complex experience that I couldn't just define in one word or two words. So there I started what I always do, even if I'm in rehearsals or in a talk with an artist, I'm sketching. So for me, those sketches became the most direct entrance for myself to the listening experience that I had, because sketching through my visual training became part of my perception without interfering with it. So based on those sketches, I made a format of field notes where always I had first the sketches, then a kind of general description of the date and the constellation where we met, how I felt, and then a particular description of the listening experience or the experience of the talk we had. And then afterwards, after a week or so, I reread those three elements. I had a look at the sketches, I had a look at the descriptions, and then I filtered out certain keynotes that triggered new questions looking back at it. And then the last step there was putting it in dialogue with some elements from the literature study, always questioning or argumenting for or against what I wrote down there. And that was my first step in developing a methodology, a kind of way of allowing myself to re-enter those experiences, but also to incorporate those sketches as a kind of full-term element in my methodology. And then later on, when I got stuck, I felt that I returned to those field notes and especially to those sketches. And it took me a while to figure out why that was, except for the reason that I was learned to think through doing in my visual practice. But then I was able to gain the insight that the reason why I was doing that was also because there it allowed me to deal with the texture of the experience. And for me, that is the most defining element of a listening experience, is that texture. So I started reworking those sketches, and the closer I got to the texture in the image that resonated with my listening experience, or that gave me the opportunity to dive directly into the essence of what I experienced there, that for me was a reason to work them and keep working on them. And then also when I came the closest to the texture, I also find a breakthrough in my thinking. So that for me helped me to get to those textures. And that for me is very nice, that if you then refer back to your reading experience, that it is also the textures of that help you. So for me, that makes sense in a way, because that is how it came about.
I now understand your use of the word textures in a more nuanced way. I mean, I understood it anyway, to reassure. But when I was reading your work, and also listening to you now talking about how you re-listened to your field notes, the documentation that you made during a process, I think that re-listening is also such an important part of the mechanism. And I just wanted to note that the connection with rehearsal, to re-hear and to re-engage hourly with a practice that is in motion is also something else that's at work there in your practice. And that's something I'm currently researching. Not that this podcast is about me, it is about your good self, your wonderful work. But I think the notion of rehearing is very pertinent at present in thinking about how the actual process and practice of making theatre, in essence, already has these listening mechanisms that are essential, ontologically essential to its manifestation or to the definition of what theatre is. So there's a really quite, there are other sort of fundamental layers. And I think there's a connection between, Leonie, what you're calling is textural, and what I might say is a mechanism, a rehearing mechanism.
Great, fascinating. Thank you. Yeah. Maybe just for clarity's sake, could you just remind us who the three practitioners are? And maybe, I know this is probably an impossible task, to try to pinpoint some of the core differences or overlaps. So how do these three practices sit in relation to each other within the context of your work, obviously, with relation to listening or to textures or to all those kind of things?
Yeah, so I must immediately add that there were four in the dissertation, but I only made an addition of the series of suggestions with three of them, because for me, the first practice is the one of Benjamin van der Wallen, and especially his sonic choreography here was for me the performance that enabled me to, or that turned me towards the switch from sound and listening in performances to the more practice and collaborative approach. For me, that was also the performance that learned me to listen, that it was about listening rather than it was about sound. So that is what I learned from here the most. And next to that, there also I, by being involved with, because it's a sonic choreography for 30 volunteers, and for a blindfolded audience. So you really only are listening. You are blindfolded and you are guided blindfolded into the performance space. So you have no idea where you are and what is happening. So often when the blindfolds went off at the end of the performance, you could hear voices in the audience saying, but who are these performers? What have they done? Because a lot of people thought it was not produced by human bodies only. So that was very, very interesting. So for me, that was a performance that made me realize that it was about listening and how important the audiencing is, but also which taught me that when you involve in or engage in working with sound and with listening, there are certain daily activities like standing, breathing, imaging, walking that are very much defining how you listen and if you are ready to listen and if you have to negotiate with how you are listening. You are also having to negotiate with how you stand, how you sit, how you look to other things. So that was a very crucial insight which I gained there, and it is what I gained from that performance that enabled me to start engaging in listening more aware in my dramaturgical practice. And in my dramaturgical practice, on the one hand, David Weber Krebs, who is a Belgian-German theatre maker. And from his practice, I mainly worked with The Guardians of Sleep, which is a performance for six performers. And in the first part of the performance, you are welcomed by one of the performers. They take you along to the stage and the tribune. They tell a very personal story, swiping through a dozen of personal images, and so you get a very fragmented and spiraling amount of information on their personal lives. And then on a certain moment they stop, they step on the stage, and for the rest of the 30 minutes that are there, they try to fall asleep. And it's there that what Linna already indicated is the only stage direction they get there is now you listen and you react to the things you hear. So where you get a very interesting dynamic between the audience and what is happening on stage and producing sounds and wriggling and the attention. If your attention drops, you as an audience, you make more sound because you adjust your position. So then you are not helping them to fall asleep. So then you get a very much a game of who is guarding who and who is trying to fall asleep. And then the second performance of Weber Krebs is The Silencing, in which you have three performers each telling or sharing or transmitting their certain experience of listening to a part of audience, but the constellation is in a triangle, so you only hear part of each story. So you're never enabled to hear the three stories, so you only get fragments of two of the stories, and there's one story you can follow throughout the whole performance. And they tell those stories by using recordings from the story they are reproducing. And then I have the Polish-Belgian choreographer Kinga Jegzewska. And from her, I'm working with two performances. One is a performative installation and one is a performance or choreography, a solo choreography, and that is Time It Takes, in which she's really trying to find the timing of the body and following that timing of the body, in which breathing plays a very crucial role. And then a very interesting shift in the performance is where the music starts rising and pumping almost. The beat is so pumping that you feel that she's reluctant on following her own rhythm, and she's really struggling because it's more easy to follow the flow of the music there. But she manages to, and there it's very interesting because through the breathing movement of her body, you are also connected through your own breathing and how it plays a role in not following her bodily rhythm, but remaining to your own breathing rhythm, and what kind of effect that has on how you audience the performance. And the other one is the performative installation Meanwhile, in which she has floating transparent objects floating through a space, and you can enter as an audience and walk through those floating objects, which has an immediate reaction to how they move through space. But also you're confronted with a way of moving that is very different to a human body moving through a space. And then we have Rita Hofek, and from Rita I have a lot of works because for her I use the term listening artist, which is a term of Daniel Scott Cunning. I find it very interesting there that she very much uses listening as an artistic practice without necessarily having sound as a result. So for me there it is very interesting that she can use that as a strategy to engage in an ambience that is already existing, while Weber Krebs and Jegzewska struggle with that illusion of creating something new in a black box, a new atmosphere. She really works with what is there already. So from her I have a booklet in which you have Pavements, which is called On a Monday. Well, for me it was very interesting to feel how I started listening through imagining, but also imagining through listening. So there you have the two elements. Normally the original concept is imagining through listening, but for me it became very clear that you could also listen through imagining, and how interesting that could be, or how what kind of crucial role this plays. And then I had Jean, which is an audio work, and Travelogue, Char and K, which is connected the one to the other, which is based on the thinking of and the work of Jean Tinguely. And in the one work, she describes how she accompanied one of the works of Tinguely from the depot to the exhibition space, where it was showcased in Inner Travels, the exhibition on the work of Rinus van der Velde. And her audio work was next to the work in that same space, so you could travel along with the artwork before it arrived at the point where it was at. And then Jean is a work that you can experience on a train, so everybody traveling with the train in the Netherlands could listen to that work. And it's about how traveling can be, how it interferes with time but also with listening. So that were the main works in the dissertation.
That gives us a great idea of the fascinating panorama, or the kind of the range of works and the range of engagements that you were able to cover and to engage with. We should probably draw to a close soon, but I just wondered, maybe two short final questions. One is that, of course, listening obviously is a very subjective experience, but I feel that sometimes in theatre there's still the idea that there's a, and big air quotes here, a normal listener in the sense of, you know, someone with functioning stereo ears, et cetera, which, of course, if we look at theater audiences, you know, is not the case. I mean, some are elderly and have some level of hearing loss. Some have sort of other forms of impairment through birth or through accidents or whatever. To what degree did your study come across an addressing of those very different kinds of listening abilities? Is that reflected in some of the works?
I think I did not in the book itself. I really, because I work also from that phenomenological perspective, and I work really from my own listening experiences. So I'm not really addressed, but that doesn't mean that I'm not aware of them. For example, in the rehearsals of The Silencing from David Weber-Krebs, I can clearly remember a showing where I was present, and also other another theater scholar from Belgium was present, and we had a completely different experience of the work. For me, it was very soothing. The silence was very accompanying. I found it very pleasurable that I had fragments and that others I couldn't hear, and that I could like kind of hear the play between them without understanding, while he got very frustrated about it, because he was labeled with ADHD, so it was very much triggering that element of not being able and being overstimulated. So it was a very overstimulating experience. And nevertheless, we kind of made the same remarks on the dramaturgical things of the performance. So for me, what I find very interesting in listening, that it is not about is it good or is it bad, but about that more complex experience. And it is, for me, listening is really much connected to allowing that complexity. And for me, there, that situation was very reassuring, that although you write from one perspective, that doesn't mean that you neglect or that you go sideways of it, or that you leave it outside, but that you, through the very particular personal experience and transmitting that and trying to reflect with that or to work with that, that it nevertheless means that there's a certain essence to listening, which is very much that allowing of that complexity. For me, in these constellations, that cannot come about.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and then finally, just where? What's next? Where are you heading? What's the next project? Where are you taking all this listening experience? If you want to share, you don't have to. But
yeah, I can share. So on a professional note, I already started a postdoc position 2 weeks ago at the Lucas School of Arts in Leuven. And I applied there with a postdoc project, which is called What If a Spoon Could Hum, which goes further on the audiencing aspect, the imagining aspects, but also what I never expected this project to bring me was that element of storytelling, which was so crucial in how to invite an audience. And there the second person perspective came up also in the storytelling, which for me was very strange very surprising, because I my position as a researcher, as dramaturg, I define that as a second person perspective. So it was very surprising that also came about in the storytelling and how those invitations were made. So that is something that I really want to dig further in, and that I feel that I'm now digging further in that second person storytelling. How does it come that is so connected to listening? So that is where I start off that What If a Spoon Could Hum element. And also the humming for me already was there in questions of can you hear the hum of the world, that are also in the series of suggestions, but which are also in the work of Hofweg, for example. And also the tension that is there, because listening for me is very active, but in the word humming, that is way more clear, that active element. So how do humming and listening and resonating, how are these three interconnected? So that is something I want to dive into. Part of that position is also I'm teaching. So I start in January teaching on the floor to a group of students, music theater. So there we go, and have an element of we make in 10 days or in 7 days, we make a short exercise of getting working based on listening. It will be and see what is going on there. And it is with music from the drama department, but also from the music department. And next to that, we are still working on the series of suggestions. So we are searching a way to keep that going, especially financially, to find a way to sustain it. But also what I just thought about a bit earlier on inviting new artists to make a new suggestion. So we are there. We have a very concrete plan, which should also happen before the final examination of the PhD. But due to COVID and whatever was postponed, so there we very soon have a launch with the first new suggestions based on the publications, and we are planning new ones. So we are having a look into who we will invite to make a. New. So that's in a very short and period what is going to be next.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm just looking forward for the work to continue and for new things to read from you and to see and to hear and to listen to, obviously. So thank you so much. Thank you, Lynn, very much for your observations, your questions, for being here. Thank you, Leonie, for sharing your work, which is fascinating. And I urge listeners to seek it out and to read it if they can get their hands on it, and just to follow you wherever they can find you. And thank you very much.
Thank you for the invitation and questions.
Thank you, Leonie.